wounding the fingers and wrist as useless. Over time, this exaggerated difference, following the use-it-or-lose-it pattern, causes the relatively unused areas to shut down. This results in the loss of control of even the parts needed to play guitar. In the end, the guitarist can play nothing. One cure, as we have seen, is to rebuild connections by playing with the whole arm, not just the fingers. This slowly re-engages the brain with a balanced, i.e. not over-specialized, neural picture of the body. Hebb's law, what fires together wires together, is a basic observation of neuroscience. If it rains while you take a first trip to Paris, the two will always be connected. But its broader implication is that the greater the variety of experience, the wider the sensory impact, the stronger the trace in the brain, and the greater the connectivity. This not only aids memory, but also guards against senility. One wonders at the current epidemic in dementia, and must concur with Dr. Mertzenich, whose brain training company treats patients suffering from cognitive decay, that we have made life too lacking in variety and multisensory demand. It's easy to live on autopilot, but do it for too long and basic cognitive abilities fall away. Instead, live polymathically and boost your brain. Only 3.4% of the population are natural specialists. Rolf Burr Lindgren, R. Meredith Belbin's Team Roles Viewed from the Perspective of the Big Five, research paper, Psychology Institute, University of Oslo, 1997. The rest of us become that way because of external forces, usually economic. And yet the great rainmakers in business are those who invent new products and even new markets by cross-fertilizing ideas from traditionally unconnected zones. By living polymathically, they don't just boost their cognitive abilities, they also manage to prosper materially. Use it or lose it. So long, and thanks for the memory. When was the last time you committed something to memory? Now that we have 4G phones, we don't need to remember anything, really. Yet we're also aware this is a small disaster. Our short and long-term memories suffer for it. Merely doing what one has always done, such as a specialist does, strengthens existing networks, but builds no new ones in the brain. It also means that short and medium-term memory are used less and less. The lesson, an intuitive one only recently supported by scientific research, is simple. If you do not use your memory, it will atrophy. If you don't visit new places where you are required to orientate yourself by, for example, learning where the shops are, finding the way back to your hotel, or even remembering where you parked your car, then you'll gradually lose even this basic skill. And it does help to think of memory as a skill. There are better and worse ways of remembering, and the good news is that there are tricks that work. For example, keeping an accurate journal, perhaps with photographs, improves recall immensely, since the major part of memory is really looking at what we are trying to recall. When everything is terribly familiar, we only glance, look at the outline, and the impression made is weak. As time goes by and familiarity grows, we end up living in a world of outlines with no detail at all. For this reason, neuroscientist and learning expert Michael Mertzenich always tries to vary his route home, making sure to pay attention to new things he sees each day. He also talks about them, which further helps his memory. But is this enough? There's something a little ad hoc, and not a little ironic, about using one's memory only when one remembers to. Dr. Stanley Kuransky, at 90 years old, described himself as a lifelong self-educator. But rather than dabble, each new interest became an engaging passion, a new subject to master. In an interview with Dr. Norman Doidge, he said, "I became interested in astronomy 5 years ago and became an amateur astronomer. I bought a telescope because we were living in Arizona at the time and the viewing conditions were so good. I'm willing to put pretty intense concentration and attention into something that interests me at the moment. Then, after I feel I've gotten to a higher level at it, I don't pay quite so much attention to that activity and I start sending tentacles to something else." Norman S. Doidge, The Brain That Changes Itself. Stories of Personal Triumph from the Frontiers of Brain Science. Penguin, 2008. Dr. Kuransky was essentially micromastering these various interests before moving on to something new, and this powerful, focused learning paid dividends with his health. Though Dr. Kuratsky had 2 heart attacks, one at 65 and another at 83, he completely recovered. His parents, who did not share his proclivities for learning, died young, his mother in her 40s and his father in his 60s. Dementia is increasingly associated not just with not learning, but also with becoming bored over time with one's environment and taking less and less acute interest in it. This lack of accuracy degrades working memory, the first stage in many chronic cognitive disorders. The fact that you have permission to learn anything, to experiment and indulge in a skill's gameability once you embrace the micromastery philosophy, is a reason never to be bored again. It's not all about books. Utilize your multisensory neurons. Don't think about making art. Just get it done. Let everyone else decide if it's good or bad, whether they love it or hate it. While they're deciding, make even more art. Andy Warhol. Word-based instruction is the way most knowledge is presently passed on. It allows standardization and control. In previous eras, a school art lesson was about micromastering drawing. Now, you may also have to read a book about art theory and learn to critique work. The critical, word-based, book-centered model downplays other ways of learning as inefficient. Simply looking and observing becomes overlooked. Micromastery, however, is more in tune with the way the brain really works. The discovery that, rather than having individual separate senses, the brain is full of multisensory neurons, brain cells that simultaneously record sound, touch, smell, and even pain, has only enhanced the idea of the mind being highly interconnected rather than compartmentalized. We are polymathic by nature, and our senses not only combine with each other, but also actually enhance one another. Bacon really does taste better when you can hear it sizzling before you eat it. Research conducted from 2012 onwards by Professor Charles Spence, head of the Crossmodal Research Laboratory at Oxford University's Department of Experimental Psychology. The perception of certain sounds relies on being able to feel those sounds. Research has shown that if you feel a puff of air corresponding to a voiced sound, you recognize that sound better, even if you feel the puff of air on your ankle. Brian Gick and Donald Derrick, University of British Columbia, Aerotactile Integration in Speech Perception, Nature 462, 26th of November 2009, pages 502 to 504. With so many senses firing close together, it's no wonder that synesthesia, the evocation of a sense different from that being directly stimulated, occurs, whereby, for example, people see music as colours. With the older, erroneous model of the brain, where each sense had its own area, synesthesia was seen as abnormal, a kind of brain damage, not helped by the fact that people with brain damage sometimes exhibited it to a high degree. But with the growing knowledge of multisensory neurons, we begin to see that synesthesia, far from being on the periphery of experience, is at its heart. Neuroscientists now believe there is a superstimulus effect, a sort of mental synergy that can be produced when we combine different senses as we really study something. This embeds deeper connections in the brain, producing faster and better learning, and also enabling us to connect to other areas we are interested in. Micromastery, by seeking out tasks that require us to use more than one sense, realigns us with this better and more natural way of operating. Are there better and faster ways to learn? Checking emails, sending texts, reading news and blogs. Who has time to learn anything, let alone slowly? Though many of us pay lip service to doing slow things like cooking from scratch or travel, we all know how hard it is to hide from a world bent on acceleration. Perhaps the only place to hide is by being deeply immersed in learning something new. As anyone who has seen a clock's hand slow in a classroom knows, the act of learning actually changes our psychological perception of time passing, making it feel as though time is moving more slowly. But even if it's pleasant to feel one can slow time down, we still want to make rapid progress in whatever we study. Michael Mertzenich has shown that we learn rapidly when something is novel or startling, or if we are focused intently upon it. In these situations, neuron growth stimulator BDNF, brain-derived neurotrophic factor, flows and makes stronger, deeper and better connections. Because each time you practice a micromastery you have to focus intently, it satisfies the condition for enhanced learning. Just as importantly, the structure of a micromastery with its reward and experimental possibilities makes each attempt novel and interesting, again speeding up learning. And a micromastery is a self-contained watchable unit which is hugely helpful to rapid learning. It's so simple, but true. We learn fastest by watching others. Aikido levels in the West lagged far behind Japan's until the advent of the internet and the mass sharing of videos and test performances that followed. Now there are Aikido practitioners who have never visited Japan, but look as if they have trained there. Just watching enables all sorts of subtle connections to be made that mere rules and instructions miss out. To restate a crucial point, the hardest part of learning is knowing the relative importance of each bit we learn. When we watch others do it, we can glean from their performance and their demeanor the relative importance of each element. Micromastery enhanced by deeper looking. In the Sahara Desert, I once had a potentially dangerous car problem fixed by a young oasis dweller called Sayed. He wasn't a professional mechanic, but he knew I had a cracked suspension unit just by looking at the stationary car without actually hearing it or seeing me driving. I didn't believe him until I checked, and only then did I manage to see the slight lean in the car that had alerted him. He told me that all summer as a kid, during the 40 to 45 degrees Celsius heat of the day, he would crawl under cars to escape the glare. Staring for hours at the exposed undersides of engines had taught him to be a mechanic. "Everything's familiar to me. I know how it connects to everything else," he told me. "By looking hard, I learned." But what does looking hard really mean? I suggest a sort of contented wide-angle vision where you aren't trying to solve anything or puzzle anything out. You're waiting for ideas to come to you rather than forcing your own ideas onto what you are observing. The 18th-century German writer and philosopher Johann Wolfgang von Goethe believed that we learned as much from deeply looking at something as we do from the usual scientific method of taking it apart and noting its constituent elements. Goethe saw that by noting the connections between the thing looked at and its environment, its rich context, we gained insights of great value. I think the key is not to be in a rush. Before visiting a country, I often hang its map on the wall. I don't ever really study it. I just kind of live with it, peering at it from time to time. All kinds of ideas for travel and writing about travel have come from this simple activity. Artists have long considered deep looking a way of capturing in the mind's eye the essence of a thing. The writer Bruce Chatwin, who had previously been a director at Sotheby's Auction House, believed that having one art object on display which you lived with and slowly consumed with all your senses, eyes, hands, everything, if you could, would, after a while, reveal all its secrets to you. When it was fully digested, you sold the piece and obtained another. By forcing us to accept a limited and contained activity, micromastery facilitates deep looking. Instead of our attention wandering across a vast field, we can zoom in and just look, and learn far faster than trying to cram various diverse facts into a protesting brain. Learning strategies are plastic too. Conventional and outdated wisdom asserts that we each have learning styles unique to ourselves. The implication is that if you don't learn using your preferred style, you'll fail to acquire the knowledge desired. It also allows you an excuse not to work hard at learning something new. In Softwired, however, Michael Mertzenich shows that the plasticity of the brain extends to the way we learn. In other words, we can learn how to learn. Indeed, we should focus strongly on this. As well as reading or attending lectures, look at cultivating different learning styles, or, more precisely, learning strategies. As we grow up, the pattern of praise and blame, encouragement and dissuasion, builds a bias towards one learning strategy over another. This becomes our default, but it may not be the most effective for you. For example, I convinced myself that I was someone who learned by doing. So when I got a new camera with an instruction manual an inch thick, I just started using it, without more than a glance at where to put the battery. A few months later, I realized that I was hardly scratching the surface of the camera's potential. Reluctantly, I sat down to go through the manual, testing things on the camera as I went. For about a week, I kept the manual with me, and after pressing buttons and trying things, I kept referring back to it. I managed to comprehend everything about operating that camera, and now I relish getting a new manual for something technical. I have found a new learning strategy that has been rewarded, and, thanks to the plasticity of my brain, this strategy is now displacing the previous insistence on always learning by doing. Micromastery enables you to experiment and use a vast array of different learning strategies. Since all are designed to succeed brilliantly, with a modicum of persistence, at the micromastery concerned, you have a perfect chance to increase your store of potential learning strategies. This, in turn, increases your ideational fluency, your ability to switch between idea sets that may be opposed or contradictory. If one strategy doesn't seem to work, no matter how wedded you are to it, you switch seamlessly to another. Ideational fluency is an attribute required of anyone working in a fast-changing, rapid learning environment, the kind increasingly encountered today. Happier and healthier. The vast number of books on happiness reflects our interest in the subject. There are over 500 on Amazon's UK site alone, and a whopping 12,000 in the Library of Congress catalogue. But how many of them correctly identify happiness as having the curious quality of retreating when you aim too directly at it? You have to sort of sidle up to happiness by doing something else. It catches you best when you're unawares. Sometimes, when we contemplate serious life projects, mountains to scale, careers to prosper at, we lose heart and retreat into consuming rather than doing and producing. Consumption becomes the default source of happiness, even if we don't want it to be. Micromastery is one way out. By identifying small, enjoyable, and self-contained instances of improvement, we move back towards a more real form of happiness. Happiness is more likely if you make a decision before doing an activity. The decision simply to act happy. By acting out the happiness you trust you will find in an area of micromastery, you liberate yourself from the yoke of thinking it is a nebulous thing out there, waiting for you to grab hold of it. By deciding to be happy, you shift from a consumer mindset to a producer mindset. You focus on the task and not yourself. And when we are in producer mindset, creating, doing, being active, we tend to be less self-absorbed and become, mysteriously, happier. And the more dimensions that activity has, the better. Why? Because a multimodal activity, like a micromastery, can combine creativity, learning, enterprise, physical and intellectual skill. It will stimulate the kind of neurotransmitters and growth factors that will make you feel good about yourself. You'll feel happier, in other words. Make it happen. John Paul Flintoff was a successful staff journalist on the Financial Times, the world's leading financial newspaper, and he was unhappy. He wasn't sure why. As a youngster, he had loved drawing and wanted to be a cartoonist, but this had been discouraged. For years, he had earned his living by typing, and that was just about all the skilled work his hands did. At the time, there had also been an outbreak of repetitive strain injuries among FT journalists, as if the body knew that to do nothing other than type was bad for it. Human beings are polymathic by nature. We have survived as a race by being bricoleurs and bodgers, using our bodies as well as our minds, not as advanced mind-only specialists. Flintoff felt that he wasn't skilled enough to use his hands for anything except operating a keyboard. But as a student, I'd always had this idea that you were what you did at that moment, he said. If you baked bread, then you were a baker. I found this idea liberating. Most of us are trapped by a sense of identity, but we can also derive power from it. By telling others that we are a tree surgeon, an artist, or a football reporter, we feel more empowered to do the job, even if our qualifications are scanty. Flintoff glimpsed the power of micromastery to outwit the confining straitjacket of identity. When you're making an omelette, You're no longer a banker trying to cook. You're someone micromastering a skill. This was the chink he needed to escape the pressure to conform. He started talking openly about his desire to use his hands after years of only using them to type. I was at a dinner party talking about this, and someone said that making a shirt was really hard, almost impossible for an amateur. Well, I was worse than an amateur. I was absolutely unskilled, but this was a challenge, which it seems is what I needed. Flintoff went home and started out on an unplanned micromastery. He was going to make a shirt from scratch. He found an old one, unpicked its seams, and laid out the parts. Just doing this was very instructive. He then used these parts as templates to cut from new cloth. He managed to construct a brand new shirt that looked pretty good. Now he had the basic model, he could experiment with it. He tried missing parts out, oversizing certain sections of the shirt, messing with collars and lengths. He had his own experimental testbed right there in the form of his sewing machine and his newly developed skills. But he didn't stop there. He went on to make all sorts of other garments, including jackets and trousers. Flintoff could have approached learning to be a tailor rather differently. He could have mastered the basics of sewing, tacking, using the machine for various stitches, practicing doing buttonholes on a blank piece of cloth, sewing rags together, and it's likely that he would have given up, with what he had learned dribbling away to nothing. How many of us learned maths, French, geography, chemistry at school, and, having never used what we learned, now recall almost nothing? When you learn the basics, it never sticks, unless you keep going to achieve something permanent like a micromastery, a distinct and recognizable unit of skill. Since most people never get past the basics, except in their specialism, most people lose most of what they learn. All of which would be supremely depressing if we didn't naturally accumulate micromasteries, even if the formal academic culture is against them or refuses to take them seriously. Flintoff set aside his conventional education, and he has a lot of it, including a master's degree in English. He hadn't lost faith in the academic method. He simply returned to what we do as children. We look for something we like and try to copy it. Flintoff told me he became incredibly happy using his hands again to make something other people admired and thought difficult to do. He had discovered the immense rewards that micromastery can bring. He was so liberated by his shirt-making that he went on to write a book about it, called Sew Your Own, Profile Books, 2011. He also found that his fear of learning new things had deserted him. He went on to study improvisational acting under the theatre genius, a term I use sparingly, Keith Johnston. He became a life coach. He started singing, and he returned to his childhood love of drawing comics. Micromastery can be a small thing, a simple thing, but it can lead you into previously unimagined realms of happiness.
Produce or consume. The specialist-centric model of human existence is an economic model. If you are a specialist, say, making shoes all day, then society benefits and you benefit. You no longer have to milk the cow and sow corn and go fishing. But what if you like doing those things? What if making shoes is okay when you do it 3 days a week, but it drives you insane if you have to do 12 hours a day, 5 days a week in an open-plan office after a 2-hour commute? Producing is more satisfying than consuming. Consuming is what is eating up the planet's resources and polluting the sea. Of course, a nice meal is enjoyable. There's no need to scarf down cans of baked beans and suffer. But micromastery switches us to a more productive view of life. We come to see that making things is simply better. Happiness comes from inside. It's a decision. Enjoyment comes from outside. It has to be sniffed out. Enjoyment gets you out of bed in the morning, but happiness helps you sleep at night. In general, the enjoyment derived from production is far more durable than the enjoyment we get from consuming. Boost confidence. Micromasteries build confidence step by step. The more micromasteries you have under your belt, the more confident as a person you will be, and not just because of the skills you gain specific to each micromastery. You will develop skills that are transferable between micromasteries: rapid learning, structural information about knowledge acquisition, performance skills, memory improvement, which is an empowering thing. Confidence plays a hugely important part in learning. But what is it? My younger self imagined confidence as some kind of inner feeling of supremacy where nothing could make me scared or nervous. But I discovered that many seemingly super-confident people are plagued by all kinds of self-doubt. Sometimes the appearance of confidence, fast-talking, loud and humorous behaviour, masks the very opposite feelings. The sci-fi writer A.E. Van Vogt put it best when he said that confidence is simply the ability to say your name clearly and loudly enough when asked, to greet someone warmly, and to congratulate them if they have something to be congratulated for. Nothing else. In other words, forget the inner feelings and make a performance decision instead. To the external observer, there is no difference between the man who can talk to anyone at the bus stop and the person who tells himself, against an inner timidity, to do so and succeeds. You see this kind of process in its most extreme form when a former stammerer goes on to become a gifted public speaker. So confidence is really a performance decision to put more energy into what you do. More directed effort is like very deliberately opening a tap, allowing energy to pour out instead of hoping it will find its way out magically. If we lack confidence, we might assume the meagre energy at our disposal is all we have. But all we need to do is make that performance decision, turn the tap, and give it more welly. When learning to sing, lack of confidence causes the singer to put less energy into the voice, which results in going more easily out of tune, off balance. This, in turn, further weakens confidence. To break the downward cycle, all you have to do is put more energy into your singing when you feel yourself going out of tune, not less. It's a case of consciously opening the tap, rather than waiting for inspiration. Lack of confidence often means we just don't try. And the single biggest cause of failure is not trying. When people self-describe as failing or being a failure, it usually transpires that they merely entertained a notion but did nothing further about it. They didn't take the extra step. They believed that it wasn't worth it, or too many others are already doing it, or I'm not good enough. But you are. Micromastery as confidence ladder. In all areas, rung by rung, we ascend a ladder of increasing confidence. With a micromastery, by its very nature, you gain full confidence before you move on to something more demanding. This is made possible by easy experimentation through repeatability. A micromastery is small and fast, easily repeatable. Repeatability breeds confidence, and if you can experiment each time you repeat, you can gain extra confidence. You'll be extending your range. The steepened learning curve will still be within your mental limits. Beating one-off paranoia. It was a fluke. Beginner's luck. How many times have you heard these kinds of expression in response to honest encouragement of early potential? Of course, beginner's luck exists. The firmament looks kindly on bold learners. But that isn't a reason to be paranoid about early success. Take everything you have going for you and use it to fuel your improvement. The accusation of beginner's luck is reduced by the fact that repeatability is built into each micromastery. It is not designed to be a one-off, so how can it be subject to one-off luck? Because a micromastery is a small and repeatable thing, it can very easily be demonstrated that you are improving. Many people have gone years without learning anything new, which has severely atrophied their confidence and ability to learn. With a micromastery, you can beat this vicious circle by watching visible external signs of incremental progress. Acknowledging that show-off ability is a social requirement. Some people might deride or belittle the human need for attention, but we all need it, some more than others, and we all learn how to get it, some of us better than others. Now, if you aren't getting enough of the right kind of attention, why not get more with your micromastery and use this attention payment as a reward to keep going? The committed and virtuous may shun such a reward, but I know that when you are on a steep learning curve, you need all the help you can get. However, there is another factor at work. Lack of confidence is connected to not liking to be watched or on display. People who lack confidence can feel a reluctance even to say their own names loudly in public, and they rather dread those little intro speeches you have to do at seminars and courses. I should know, because that's me as well. It isn't the watching so much as the imagined judging which is the problem. You may be quite happy to try your three-card trick in front of a couple of friendly 8-year-olds, but not a snarky teenager. No one likes to be judged, but a micromastery puts you outside the judging zone because it is only one of many versions. Doing the task badly matters less. When I make an omelette for someone, I could get nervous. What if I fail? But then I remember that the whole point is that I am on the path to mastery, not one-off success. This is just one more step, and if they say it is less than perfect, I'll try hard to thank them sincerely for deigning to eat my food, and my next one will be better. Refine and reboot your bucket list. Though I prefer the more positive-sounding term wish list, I have a strong belief in such lists as a life-changing tool. We can either look at life as something externally driven, getting promoted, elected, chosen, cheered, or we can choose to look at it as something we have more control over, a simple list of things we wish to have done before we are too frail to do anything. Micromasteries in some form or another feature high on most people's wish lists. American author and polymath Clifford A. Pickover, a great proponent of the wish list, has several in his top 10, from Sex, Drugs, Einstein and Elves, Smart Publications, 2005. 1. Play Bach's Toccata and Fugue in D minor. 2. Learn Chang-style Tai Chi. 3. Obtain a PhD. 4. Write a novel and sell it. 5. Raise Amazon Golden Severum Fish. 6. Play bass guitar in a rock band. 7. Eat spicy tekamaki. 8. Own a Mitsubishi 30GT sports car with stick shift. 9. Fire an Uzi and a Magnum 45. 10. Publish a technical paper with a triple integral symbol. Though firing an Uzi machine gun is hardly a micromastery, doing it well is. And while owning a sports car with a manual gearbox might seem a little devoid of skill, driving it in the manner it deserves is also susceptible to micromastery. Pickover is a likably eccentric polymath who has written over 30 books that range from science fiction to hard maths. He has many patents to his name and is a specialist in speech recognition software research, which he pursues in his day job as a fellow at the Thomas J. Watson Research Center in New York. As you might guess from his list, most of which he has achieved, he has micromastered a wide range of skills. Google his Wishing Project for more on this. The whole of Pickover's ethos is polymathic in nature. Use cross-fertilization from different fields to advance both your life and your specialist area, if you have one. The problem with the wish list is that it can become a list of consumables rather than real achievements. And it is a little weird to do things solely to look back on them. Surely they should be good at the time, too. There needs to be balance. By making a wish list of micromasteries, you have something that is interesting to do, useful forever, and nice to look back on. Micromastery and a flow state of mind. Flow is a concept we touched upon at the start of the book, popularized by the Czech psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. The central idea is that when we become fully immersed in activity, we enter a state of mind where we're no longer conscious of time. Concentration is enhanced and we feel fully alive, though reflecting on such things can interrupt the flow state. It's only in retrospect that we recall such feelings. When you are in a flow state, your critical stop-go-judging way of thinking is switched off. You learn faster as a result. While conventional ways of learning actually militate against achieving it, micromastery encourages the formation and sustaining of a flow state. Take the simple act of drawing Zen circles, which we looked at in What is Micromastery? You can easily drop into the semi-meditative and fully immersed flow state while endlessly attempting to draw the perfect calligraphic circle with pen or brush. You can easily achieve what might even be called a micro-flow state when you dip in and practice for 10 or 15 minutes a language or a skill that is relatively simple, such as spinning a basketball on your finger. Getting into a flow state of mind is something that improves with practice. You begin by identifying a challenge which you have the skills to master. If the challenge is greater than the skills you need, you'll notice that your arousal levels rise, even causing anxiety if your skills are poor. If your skills are over and above what the challenge requires, you enter what is called a control state, which over time can degenerate into boredom. In between being agitated and being too much in control lies the flow state. Start by really focusing 100% because distractions are fatal. Set aside enough time. Although a flow state is timeless, time pressure will stop it happening. Finally, monitor your own inner state. Are you anxious, bored, energized? A micromastery is almost a perfect method to experience flow. The challenge is precise, the skills needed are not hard to learn. When you enter the repetition and experimentation stage of micromastery, you can improve awareness of flow by monitoring yourself on the spectrum from boredom through to arousal or anxiety. Use numbers. 0 for bored, 1 for relaxed, 2 for control, 3 for flow, 4 for arousal, 5 for anxious. Up the challenge if it feels routine. If you find you're getting nervy and agitated, slow down. Lower the challenge and then work on your skills. Hitting the 3 sweet spot is amazing. Time stands still. I have practiced micromastering line sketches and thought it was lunchtime when it was 4:30 p.m. 4 hours just disappeared in a state of full concentration and enjoyment. It was a complete sense of being present. Escape the overcomplicated trap. Complexity scientist Samuel Arbesman's book, Overcomplicated, relates a common problem in this world. We are losing control of it through the sheer proliferation of systems and technologies that govern our lives and which we don't fully understand. Samuel Arbesman, Overcomplicated, Technology at the Limits of Comprehension, Penguin, 2016. Micromastery provides, in miniature, an opportunity for simplicity and subtlety. One can experiment with omelette making and learn all its inner secrets without being trapped by overcomplication. With each new level of subtlety, the brain assigns single neurons to do the task that earlier on in learning required a whole ring of neurons. The world is an incredible place, but in the last 100 years it has become a very complicated one in which to live. Most of human existence has been spent as hunter-gatherers, a simple life, but one which has all sorts of possibilities for mastery. It's an existence where you can start small and humble at anything. But though we have created many wonderful toys and improvements, we've also created a complication threshold over which anyone interested must pass, and it simply puts people off. You can't just do stuff. You need the right kit, qualifications, maybe a doctorate, insurance, permission. We're put off by how everything seems to be so darn complicated, and the reaction is either rejection or to give in and embrace some tiny corner of complicated ritual. I have a friend who revels in oil company contracts, sees them as promising a sort of near enlightenment after the workout they've given his brain. Or you can throw away everything that smacks of complexity, which includes the subtle, but then the world becomes dumb and stupid. We need to avoid drowning in complexity. By breaking tasks down into micro-masteries, we return to a world in which simplicity and subtlety can retain a useful place. Multiple micro-mastery and synergy. Having one micro-mastery is nice, but the nature of the game is to want more. If your micromasteries are all in the same field, whether that be craft beer making, tap dancing, or nuclear physics, then you are closing in on mastery. It makes sense to define a master as someone who is super competent at a required number of micromasteries within his or her field. Serious learning requires that we stay focused and on track, but this doesn't mean we have to be interested in only one thing for all of our lives. It's important not to confuse the correct learning strategies, which very definitely require you to be focused and on track, with living strategies, which have more subtle requirements. Doing the same thing every day of your life will kill you with boredom. Doing the same thing every day for a period of time while you aim to master something is a proven and effective learning strategy. You then switch to something new, maybe a new micromastery. Be on track until you find yourself in a rut, then switch tracks. Micromastery makes switching tracks pain-free, easy, and part of the program. We aren't meant to be specialists.
As we mentioned earlier, one study showed that only 3.6% of the population are naturally inclined to specialisation. If you are part of the rest of the population, read on. And even if you aren't, read on. According to extensive research for UNESCO by Dr. Robert Root Bernstein, we found that compared with typical scientists, Nobel laureates are at least 2 times more likely to be photographers, 4 times more likely to be musicians, 17 times more likely to be artists, 15 times more likely to be craftsmen, 25 times more likely to be writers of non-professional writing, such as poetry or fiction, and 22 times more likely to be performers, such as actors, dancers, or magicians. That's from R. Root Bernstein and M. Root Bernstein's keynote speech, Arts at the Centre, paper presented at UNESCO, the Second World Conference on Arts Education, Seoul, Korea, 25th to the 28th of May, 2010. These Nobel Prize-winning scientists are specialists, but they enhance their speciality with outside interests, thus gaining new perspectives. Being polymathic isn't just the province of the genius. It's open to everyone. All you need are multiple micromasteries. The current interest in the portfolio career reflects our need and willingness not to stick to one occupation all the time. And as we've seen, even if you do desire a more conventional single occupation career, it pays to feed it with multiple micromasteries. Suppose you have a child who seems unusually talented at science and appears to have a natural inclination towards maths and physics. You might be tempted to engage a maths tutor, hopeful that your offspring will achieve great things thanks to early specialization. Walter Alvarez, a doctor, saw things differently. His son Luis was gifted in science, but he chose to balance this by sending him to a school noted for arts and crafts. Instead of fast-tracking through advanced calculus, Luis worked at technical drawing and woodwork, which didn't stop him from going on to study science later and ultimately win the 1968 Nobel Prize in Physics. Luis attributed his success to his ability to build any experimental apparatus he could imagine. Developing fine motor skills was also essential to the success claimed by celebrated U.S. astronaut Story Musgrave. He grew up on a farm, where he learned the skills to fix anything, which was just as crucial in a space station as it was to his later degrees in engineering and medicine. There is informal recognition of the advantage of a polymathic background. 82% of scientists and engineers surveyed by Robert Root Bernstein answered yes to the question, would you recommend an arts and crafts education as a useful or even essential background for a scientific innovator? Reported in Robert Root Bernstein et al., Entrepreneurship in Science and Engineering Correlates with Sustained Arts and Crafts Participation. Invited Lecture, National Endowment for the Arts and the Brookings Institution, Washington, D.C., 10th of May, 2012. Arts and crafts are the natural home of micromastery, self-contained, scalable, repeatable, defined. Scientists and engineers are not alone in needing inspiration from elsewhere. Artists and writers also gain from having a non-arts background. W.H. Auden, Somerset Maugham, Anton Chekhov, and David Foster Wallace all had maths or science educations in addition to their literary pursuits. Foster Wallace was also a junior tennis player. Jack Kerouac and Ken Kesey were both American football players. Albert Camus played in goal for the Algerian national soccer team, and Samuel Beckett was a notable cricket player in his native Ireland, the only Nobel laureate to feature in the Wisden Cricketer's Almanac. When he was a child, Alexis Carrel, Nobel Prize winner in medicine in 1912, was taught by his lace-making mother how to stitch incredibly tiny and intricate patterns. He later used this skill in making groundbreaking advancements in the field of surgery. Hans von Euler-Chelpin focused on fine arts at college before an interest in colour led him to the sciences, and he would eventually win the 1929 Nobel Prize in Chemistry. Leading astrophysicist Jakob Shaham claimed, "Acting taught me how to read equations like a script with characters I had to bring to life." All these high achievers demonstrate the same thing. There is great synergy in having multiple areas of expertise. Synergy means, among other things, that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. By having several micromasteries, you're not just a great person who has some impressive life hacks to show off.
Each one of these micromasteries enhances the acquisition of more knowledge so that you can deploy it with greater effect. Synergy between different areas of knowledge, not just academic but also practical, is little studied. After all, what field would it come under? One of the few to have studied it is Carl Gombrich of University College London. He has found that students who study sciences and arts at A-level, a minority in the UK, are later more likely to have positions of responsibility and leadership by 6 orders of standard deviation, a hugely positive correlation. That's from Carl Gombrich, Polymathy, New Generalism and the Future of Work, A Little Theory and Some Practice from UCL's Arts and Sciences degree in William C. Kirby and Marie C. van der Ende, eds. Experiences in Liberal Arts and Science Education from America, Europe and Asia, A Dialogue Across Continents, Palgrave Macmillan, 2016. The more you know, and the greater number of different perspectives you have on things, the exponentially better it is for you. Fields of knowledge cross-fertilize in many, often surprising ways. The kernel of creativity is, after all, putting together things that have never been put together before. Synergy is the extra energy liberated in a system when its constituent parts benefit each other. In a sense, it's like an economy of scale for a system. It's not a new idea. In fact, it's been around since Aristotle. The usual one-line definition is that the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, but that tends to deflate the truly mysterious nature of synergy. As well as system synergy, there are synergies in creativity, the cross-fertilizing of previously unrelated ideas to make new ones. We have seen how skills can sabotage each other at the rub-pat barrier, but there are also synergetic skills. For example, competence in Aikido will help any kind of bodily skill acquisition, from golf to dancing. Systems thinking involves looking at a system in its entirety, rather than breaking it down into bits. A stationary car is merely a collection of parts, but a car plus driver is a system. If you want, say, to win a Formula One race, you think of the entire system of control and feedback involving the driver and the car he is driving. If you think solely in a reductionist way, looking at engine, gearbox, aerodynamics, you'll end up with a less than optimal solution. With the car plus driver system, we can come up with synergetic combinations that take into account the driver's relationships with different parts of the car. We can optimize these relationships and the driver's skills with tire and fuel combinations that particularly suit him. In a way, systems thinking is with us in everyday life when we consider the effect of an institution, say a school, on an individual. We informally acknowledge the synergy of a good school, the subtle combination of ethos, resources, and good teachers that a skilled head teacher knows how to marshal. Anyone who has done group exercise has probably experienced the synergy when the whole group tries hard and each individual gets a boost in stamina that they would never get if training alone. These examples also perhaps indicate how slippery a concept synergy can be and why reductionists are suspicious of it. This is summed up in the joke about the reductionist scientist who tears a butterfly apart, labels each part, and when asked where the butterfly has gone, answers, "What butterfly?" Synergy is experienced as a sudden addition of energy, a quantum leap, rather than a linear progression, a steady rise. When you already have several micromasteries, they can all improve suddenly when you learn another one. People hoping to master martial arts often report flat progress. They are on the plateau. Then suddenly, they go up a level, make a quantum leap. It can be so exciting, and they expect the rise to continue, but soon they level out to a new plateau. That quantum rise is the synergy between the micromasteries. You can break a big area of activity into smaller micromasteries. It's the usual way to learn everything from cooking to martial arts. Aikido, for example, requires learning several micromasteries. 4 different locks, various takedowns and throws, precise methods of stepping and moving. As you acquire each micromastery in turn, it helps a little with the ones you already know. Some are particularly synergetic. They naturally boost each other. When attempting to master an entire field, it makes sense to map it out with progressive and synergetic micromasteries. This is different from mastering the basics. Each micromastery stands alone and does not need the others in order to make sense. However, its acquisition informs existing micromasteries and helps all-round improvement. Skills transfer. The more you know, the easier it gets. Not just in foreign languages and sports, but in every area of learning. There is a crossover in skills and perspectives and insights. Sometimes these areas of crossover can be quite close. Pilots who are used to one type of plane are retrained quickly for another type by maximizing the common knowledge needed for both. But much wider skill transfer is possible. Yukio Mishima, Japanese novelist, was a fourth dan black belt at kendo and a first dan at karate. Though he was a late starter at both sports and stiff in his movements, his tests were described as very impressive. Mishima said that when he was being tested for his black belt, he just switched into the same frame of mind he used when writing. Writers such as D.H. Lawrence, Henry Miller, and Jean Cocteau were also well-regarded visual artists. The kind of sensibilities formed by their writing gave their art power and conviction, even though they were not trained in drawing and painting. Crossover skills can include timing and intensity of action. From Aikido, I learned how to apply maximum force with little preparatory movement or thought. I found this experience of delivering full-on power in bursts useful when mastering new skills, as diverse as kneading bread or using a bow drill to make fire. Shift your perspective. How fast can you shift perspective? In a changing world with evolving technologies, it's no longer a luxury. Having identified some of your own micromasteries, your identity undergoes a subtle shift. Instead of a one-size-fits-all perspective conditioned by your work identity, you can try on another suggested by a micromastery. You get used to changing your perspective. You could, for example, ask of any problem how a canoeist or a chef, for example, might look at it. By adopting the polymathic perspective, one of ideational fluency gained from having multiple micromasteries, you automatically switch from closed to open. By this I mean a general view on life, a feeling of being open to life's wonders, marvels, and opportunities. You become open to learning. Because you know the micromastery secret of acquiring expertise, you don't feel shut out by the expertise of others. You become quietly confident and fearless, a good combination in any circumstances. Being stuck, rigid, unable to move, is what stops progress. Sometimes we throw money at the problem or use excessive force, half knowing that we're going to break the thing before we start. We go head-on and often meet massive opposition to what we're trying to achieve. Military strategies that emphasize a straight charge usually fail. A feint and a surprising flank attack work much better. This is what changing your viewpoint does for you. But you can only change viewpoints if you have another. And as a polymathic micromaster, of course, you will. The Mysteries of Mastery. In this book about micromastery, mastery itself remains forever on the horizon. Micromastery has many elements in common with mastery, but it is also often simply the first step towards it. Let's look a little closer at what we mean by mastery itself. Being a master of something. What an enviable thing. We imagine the master has a more satisfying life, deeper insights into reality. We know that masters must spend long hours honing their skill. There is usually some kind of apprenticeship. The main thing is the amount of time, 10,000 hours, according to recent popular research, though it's easy to be a little skeptical about that, as time alone is not enough. The manner of the master is all important. His or her attitude to learning and improving their skill. Mastery is about keeping going, mainly. It's about being comfortable on the plateau. It's about the long haul, not the quick fix or the shortcut. Shortcuts are attractive, but they are never easy. Usually they involve greater energy and commitment, which can result in burnout. When I watched Aikido masters in Japan, I saw how they enjoyed their training. They didn't try too hard, because they knew they were in it for the long haul. The mantra of the master is, whatever keeps you on the path to mastery is good. Whatever causes you to deviate is bad. Mastery is about seeing the deep relationships and important causative features. When I started Aikido, I thought it was all about getting the right angle, the right move. Slowly I realized that it was more important to think about stance and balance When these are right, you do the right moves almost automatically. Mastery requires commitment, but of the right kind. You can't be too keen or too obsessed, otherwise you won't see the wood for the trees. On the other hand, you have to do a lot of it. As master photographer Daido Moriyama always says, you just have to take a lot of pictures. Balance is built into every layer of what we call mastery. The fine and even finer balance between doing too much and not enough. And balance is one of those things you have to feel. At first, maybe, in the diluted form you may find in a book or instructional video. But then you'll have to learn to feel it yourself. One reason Japanese master carpenters do so much work by eye is to build up an enhanced trust in their intuitive powers of seeing and appreciating good balance. Masters keep going at what they do. They bend before opposition, but do not break. They take the path of least resistance, as long as it is still the path. Masters use ritual instead of repetition to achieve long-term, maybe even dimly conceived, goals. Ritual is making repetition into something fun that you look forward to, or at least tolerate. You can make a ritual out of anything, even checking emails. You have your special email-checking chair, a cup of Ethiopian coffee, best drunk at 47 degrees centigrade, your email-checking hat. You get the picture. George Leonard, a master of Aikido and also of writing about mastery, noted that there comes a point when you have to surrender to your craft or field. You have to take it on its own terms. This makes you open and non-critical at a time when criticism is of little use. It means you stop talking and start watching. It is the point when mild obsession can take over. You cannot become mechanical, though, which is where obsession will ultimately take you. You need to maintain that experimental drive, testing, looking, observing. You need to take risks from time to time, knowing full well that some will fail with a resounding fanfare, and some will always be an astonishing success. Polymathic paradise. We are taught that focusing on and specializing in one thing alone is the key to success and happiness in life. The latest versions of this credo usually include constant references to passion. However, you'll discover that the opposite is in fact true. Oh, sure, at the moment of engagement, all successful people are 100% focused, but that is only for a small fraction of their lives. The rest of the time, they either rest or draw nourishment from elsewhere. We've already seen that Nobel Prize-winning scientists, the very definition of a single-minded specialist, are actually many times more likely to study arts, crafts, or music than an ordinary academic scientist. But they keep it quiet. In a specialist culture, the polymathic impulse has to be hidden. A polymath uses their multiple areas of expertise and interest to feed and nurture their specialism, if they are a specialist, providing new perspectives and energy. Polymathic people have higher energy and more interest in life and are happier and less fragile. They are open rather than closed, the default setting of those following a singular path. Until this very recent historical period, people had to be polymathic just to survive. But the proliferation of complex industrial manufacturing techniques, huge economies of scale in all areas of food production, the ubiquity of mass entertainment through TV and the internet, and the computerization of even the lowest level work have enabled the specialist worldview to proliferate at the expense of our very human polymathic selves. Entrepreneurial, innovative, and creative activity all require a polymathic outlook. At the highest levels of science, polymathy is alive and well. Scientists constantly borrow from other fields to make progress in their own. The key problem now is simply how to reintroduce our lost heritage of multiple expertise into everyday lives and jobs. After university, instead of following a traditional career path, I went to Japan and spent 3 years learning martial arts. While there, I glimpsed the idea that over time would become micromastery. 1 whole year was spent in a traditional dojo shared with the Tokyo Riot Police. I went from zero to black belt instructor level by virtue of studying 5 hours a day, 5 days a week, but this was almost incidental. The real benefit was in discovering how to learn.
The Japanese way of teaching is to break everything down into self-sustaining routines which work on their own, but also lead into the greater whole. Part of this is kata, repetitious movements such as punching and kicking. But part of it in Aikido becomes techniques, self-contained ways of immobilizing an opponent. Within a single technique, such as the